Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. Yes, as of today, I have a temperature of 97.3, and I'm asymptomatic, very happy to report that. This is one of those real black swan events that we're experiencing. Now, before we go any further, I am just going to talk a little bit about hoarding, because that's one of those things that we've been really experiencing lately. And I need to address that issue a little bit. So the whole toilet paper thing, I mean, we were laughing a couple of weeks ago about the people scrambling to get toilet paper and food, but especially toilet paper. And I heard a very interesting psychological analysis about how when we're feeling afraid that our disgust goes up, and so we feel disgusted about not having enough toilet paper. It was your typical psychological analysis, which means speculative, by definition, almost. So let's keep that in mind, because there's a whole lot of that going on, too. But getting back to hoarding, the most important thing to understand about hoarding, and we see it again and again, is that hoarding creates artificial shortages, and it creates a positive feedback loop. It raises fear of not having enough. And so by hoarding, we actually damage the situation, and we don't really help ourselves. So exerting some rationality and some self-control is very important. Another reason it's very important is because crazy ideas are getting released prematurely and leading to bad outcomes. So I want to address the hydroxychloroquine mess. Now, there's an artificial shortage that was created by fear, created by people who were concerned about the internet, read something. And then, of course, we had very prominent people on Twitter, such as Elon Musk and our own president tweeting stuff about that. And that led to a bad outcome, that bad outcome being that there is now effectively a global shortage of what was previously an abundant substance. So let's examine the hydroxychloroquine thing a little bit more. Because the study that was the first study that talked about this, that was released by Didier Roulat of France in conjunction with an Italian author whose name I'm sorry I don't have at the top of my brain. That study was looking at people who were moderately ill, who were in the hospital, and who were on an EKG monitor. And they received the drug, and what the study reported was that their nasal swabs cleared and that they recovered and went home. There was no control group. This was what we call a case control group. They picked another similar number of people. And because the number was so small, the possibility of a statistical failure of this being just a coincidence is very, very high, on the order of probably 30% if you do the analysis. Their statistical power analysis is just plain wrong, that they could provide any kind of statistical certainty with this size control group. But we won't get into the technical weeds too much. I'm going to give you a couple of a speculation about that study, which is because it used what we call a surrogate marker, which is to say nasal swabs, which they actually had in France and Italy, they saw that the nasal swab went negative. But that doesn't really prove anything, because that is an ELISA test. That is a test for the viral RNA. And the problem with that is that sometimes chemical substances in the bloodstream will interfere with tests. This is called an interfering substance phenomenon. And even if hydroxychloroquine really does cause nasal swabs to go negative, it doesn't mean it actually helps fight the virus. The evidence for that is tenuous and theoretical. And no, there isn't a good study out of China. It wasn't a placebo trial either. It was a Hail Mary pass. And even if it's true, the people who are hoarding it because they think it's going to prevent an infection. It might help people like this who have moderate proven COVID not graduate to a ventilator, which, in case you haven't heard, we don't actually have enough ventilators, nowhere near close to enough ventilators for what's predicted. So if the data, such as it is, shows that that's the group that stands to benefit the most, you need to be on an EKG monitored bed for this stuff. It can cause, there's this rare event that it can cause where the electricity wave in your heart just goes into a self-perpetuating sine wave. It looks rather like a generalized grand mal seizure of the heart. For us, it's a type of ventricular fibrillation called torsade de points, or in American, torsade des points. But it's a lethal disease. So to those people who bought up the supply, which is now quite low, unless you are one of the people out there on the front lines, and I hear a lot of doctors did get this stuff for themselves, unless you're out there helping keep people alive, give it back. Give it to the hospitals. Give it to the people who might benefit. It is just too preliminary to really know. But if we're going to know soon, then let's at least use it in the group that's going to show us that it's true. Everybody has an advantage there. Then maybe we can commandeer a couple of pharmaceutical companies, forget about the bloody friggin' patents, and start manufacturing the stuff. Yeah, maybe that could happen. Which brings me to my next fear topic, bureaucratic fear. We've been seeing a beautiful example of that. And bureaucratic fear, and maybe a certain amount of opportunism as well, but really I'm thinking bureaucratic fear is what we're looking at here. And bureaucratic fear is fear of making a mistake, fear of losing one's job, fear of being blamed for making a mistake. And let's face it, the internet has definitely turned us into a blaming and shaming culture. And that's our own fault for letting it happen. We really need to think about that. Right now, we're still in a situation where supplies are not being released where they're most needed. They're still working on, last I heard, which was yesterday morning, they're still working on logistics for distribution. Not declaring an emergency sooner, not shutting down New York sooner. Lots of worries about political consequences. And this is a moment when people need, particularly people in political office, need to be heroes. Real heroes who risk themselves and their reelectability to try and hold a situation together. If the general on the front lines of a battlefield is worried about the optics of his battlefield decisions back in Washington, he's unlikely to be a successful general. And we had a lot of that, by the way, if you've ever studied the Civil War, we had a lot of that going on in the first couple of years of the Civil War. It's one of the reasons it went on so long. So moving to what exactly can we expect from this? I have a graphic here that I just want to walk you through. I will post a link to this on the AskDrDawn.com website. And what this graphic shows is that we have a stage one early infection phase, and that goes on for a couple of weeks. We know we've got an incubation period, and then we have a stage one infection period. And then if it progresses and it doesn't get bounced off by the immune system, then we move into the pulmonary phase. And the pulmonary phase also can last up to a couple of weeks. So now we're at 4 weeks sick and 2 weeks before that potentially contagious. Then we move in to a small percentage of people, and these are the ones who get the so-called cytokine storm. The stage two phase, the pulmonary phase, those are the ones that actually start to have low oxygen. And so here's some news you can use. If you have low oxygen, normal exercise, like stairs in your house, you won't be able to do it. That either means you're having an asthma attack, which if you are, you probably know what that feels like, or you have room air hypoxemia. Whatever exercise you can do right now that doesn't make you out of breath, that's what you do. And if suddenly your exercise tolerance has dropped, then that's when you seek assistance, emergency care. That's when you're going, even if you don't have a fever, that's when the public health people will test you, according to the current guidelines. So what you do then is you call 211. There is also an emergency operations center and a clinical call center that you can call, and that is 831-454-4221. But you can text COVID-19, no hyphen, to 211-211, and you'll also get help. So we're trying to give people as much information as they can get, but ultimately only a very small percentage of people move into hyperinflammation, and that's the cytokine storm that is now all over the internet, along with all sorts of advice about how not to get the cytokine storm. And it's not that this is bad advice, but really. So let's go to our first question, and this was a Gmail from Michael in Santa Cruz. What about phage therapy? I'm just reading this cold. So hi, Dawn, it's Michael from the Meetup Santa Cruz French group. Hi, Michael. Did you manage to read The Perfect Predator? If so, it said a little something about your take on phage therapy and or the medical thriller story of the San Diego professors and their story. Is there any way this therapy could help us with our present viral problems, even though it's for bacterial infections? You and Charles take care of each other, and I hope to see you again at the Tabby Cat Cafe. Yes, Michael? Please, thank you for listening to KSQD Online. We appreciate it. Thank you for emailing. Makes me feel a little less alone, and I do so appreciate that. To answer your question, phage therapy will not work for viruses. In fact, phages are viruses, and there isn't. They might compete with each other to infect your cells, but they won't. They won't help. Phages basically are viruses for bacteria. Going to take just a moment and let Howard make any announcements that he needs to make. And after that, I'll be back with more information.
All right. Thanks, Don. Just a reminder that your listeners are tuned into KSQD Santa Cruz. That's at 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. I'm Howard Feldstein. I'll be your host for Giant Steps. Coming up at 7 o'clock, we have jazz from 7 to 10, music all night long here at KSQD. We're trying to keep everyone's spirits lifted and our normal programming on as much as possible. So do enjoy the jazz tonight. I have one comment, actually, more information about shortages and hoarding. I actually work in the grocery industry. So some of what's going on is indeed some level of hoarding or people being a scarcity mentality. And some things maybe are in short supply. But part of it is what's going on is there's this kind of a shift that is happening in the supply chain as well that maybe some people aren't conscious of. That there are, many people normally eat meals out at restaurants or eat at work. There are many meals eaten at schools, K-12, colleges, universities, corporate campuses, workplaces, institutions. And with no one going to those places, they're now eating at home. And so the demand on grocery stores is higher than it usually is, and whereas it's down at restaurants and at these other places. So there are products at some of these other institutions that need to be redistributed. And then on the wholesale side, things that normally go to an institution or to a Google campus or an Apple campus or an IBM campus or a UCSD campus or a Cabrillo campus or a middle school campus, those things, whether it's toilet paper in institutional size packs or foods, have to be repackaged and for retail and redistributed. So that adjustment is happening fairly quickly. So that's part of what's going on. from other sources or redistribution too soon. But for the most part, I think supply will come around and meet demand, and we'll see how long the whole thing lasts, that we are not eating at restaurants and elsewhere, that we are eating only through grocery stores. So that's something to be considered there in this. And I think we're ready now to send things back to Dr. Dawn. We are online at ksqd.org. Dr. Dawn, you ready?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Howard, for a nice dose of rationality. And also, if you can, I was curious about the redistribution, pulling stuff out of what are effectively now empty, large campuses where everyone's working from home. I know some of that's going on, but is there? Could you answer my question about whether or not there's an organizational strategy organizing the large, for example, the large tech companies? Are they communicating with each other, or how are things getting back into the stream where the people who are sheltering in place can access it?
You know, I'm not sure about the inventory that is on hand at these campuses, if that's being taken out of those places, because some of them maybe didn't have that much inventory, or are, you know, will need something when they reopen, in whether it's 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 5 weeks, whatever it is. I do know that on the wholesale side, the reorganization is happening very quickly, so that wholesalers, they still want to sell product and they want to meet demand. So they are gearing up, and they are very quickly turning things around so that they're not shipping to campuses, but they are shipping more and more and more to grocery stores and that sort of, you know, retailers.
We have a lot of resilience in our system of distribution, and that's a wonderful thing to keep in mind. We can adapt, and we are in the process of doing it. And I think everyone is doing their part. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, one other quick thought. I noticed, you know, when people see lines at the stores, they might think, oh my God, people are lining up to buy more and more. But part of the lines now is that they're limiting the number of people in stores so that they have more space in between people in those stores. So it doesn't necessarily mean people are buying more. This means, or that there are more people in the store. There are actually fewer people in the store at one time. That creates the line outside so that they limit to 30 or 40 people inside instead of the normal 60 or 70. So again, you might think, oh my God, I need to step in that line and get it before it all runs out. No, it's just a matter of they're it's kind of like at a museum. They're parceling out the number of people who can go to see the Mona Lisa at any one time. And, that doesn't necessarily mean there's a run on products at that moment.
I have a funny story about the Mona Lisa at the Louvre. Humor, right? So we went to see the famous painting by Leonardo da Vinci, and we get into the room where the Mona Lisa is. And I swear to God, most of the people who were in that front rank to look at the Mona Lisa had their back to her and were taking a selfie. And I have to share that was a very weird thing, because people used to just stand there and gaze at the Mona Lisa. And now they take a picture of themselves in front of the Mona Lisa with their back turned. I wonder what Leonardo would think of that.
Well, same thing at the Grand Canyon and, at a great sunset. It used to be just go and enjoy the sunset, or go and just gaze and awe at the Grand Canyon. Now, of course, you're taking your selfie while you fall backwards into it. So
I think that actually happened. All right. Well, thank you, Howard. All right. We've got another email, this one from Troy. And so Troy asks, does colloidal silver spray kill the virus if on the hands? Can't get alcohol at present. How long does the virus persist if on food? Should we stop eating berries? For sanitizing objects, surfaces, etc., how much bleach per gallon? All right, I'm going to start with your third question, Troy. And the answer is 4 teaspoons per liter. So that would be 16 teaspoons per gallon. That's the answer. That's straight from the CDC website. As far as the virus persisting on food, I have been advising, and I have posted at the top of my website, askdrdawn.com, you can find an actual webpage that has a list of things, of suggestions, best practices. And I'm very pleased to see that a lot of the things I was suggesting like last Monday are actually last Monday, so very early on in this, have actually been picked up by other people. And most of it's just logic and stuff that I evolved when I was taking care of my mother during her life. So to answer your question about berries, what I recommend, and it's probably overkill, is I recommend that you take that bleach spray or simply make a dipping solution for your vegetables. Use a colander for your fruits and vegetables. Just drop them in there for 10 seconds in the colander. Dip it, in other words. Pull it out and rinse the heck out of it with just regular plain water until you cannot smell or taste bleach. And then you will have very effectively deviralized and, for that matter, removed bacteria from your food. It's totally overkill under ordinary circumstances, but right now I don't think so. And I will just share with you that I am spraying all things that come from the supermarket that someone might have touched using this method, if it's plastic especially, and we'll come to that in a moment. As for colloidal spray, I recommend saving your colloidal silver spray for your nose. It probably does kill virus on the hands, but the bleach will as well, that 4% bleach water. Again, you can treat your hands just like the precious berries that they are. 10 seconds of the bleach water, and then it's sprayed on, and then rinse, 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 and maybe throw a little oil on because the bleach is really drying. But very effective. If you can't get soap at that moment, that's something that you can do. I'm going to move to my next article, but let me go back so I can monitor the mail. Good. So this article is exactly that. Some wonderful people. Let's see, where are these people? They're down in L.A., UCLA, Center for Disease Control, all sorts of good places. They did a really wonderful study. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine this week, and it's how aerosol and surface stability of SARS-CoV as compared with SARS-CoV-1. So we're talking about the COVID-19. There's two different names. SARS-CoV-2 is the one that you want to be watching, that you want to think of as COVID-19. And yes, virologists are actually fighting about what to call this. No comment. Now, getting back to this, this is really news you can use. They checked five environmental conditions: aerosols, plastic, stainless steel, copper, and cardboard. They did each one three times. They looked at the decay rate, and they looked at how long before no viable virus could be measured. So the winner in terms of the surfaces here was copper, but I'll give you the aerosol data in just a moment. But the copper data is really important. So 4 hours on copper, which is really, really useful to know. There are copper screens out there still at the hardware stores. There are copper, craft copper. Copper is a very good way to sterilize your phone. In fact, you may not be able to buy them, but a month ago you could buy a little copper padded thing to put your electronics in, because you leave them in there overnight. It's known to kill just about all germs, including, as it happens, COVID-19. Okay, cardboard is a little trickier. So in terms of your duration on cardboard, you're looking at, let me see here, about 40 hours before the titer goes to undetectable. So the half-life on cardboard is really short, but half-life means there's still some COVID there. What I have been doing and recommending, I think it's actually in that paper that's posted to my website at the very top, is to airlock your mail. If there's something that you really need to open right now, like a check from the government, it's in that article, you can do that. You can airlock your mail and let it sit for 48 hours. And that allows you to simply not even have to spray paper. But if you do need to do that, you can spray it with the bleach water, and that's a perfectly effective strategy. Our issues are plastic and stainless steel. To get to a titer of undetectable, you're looking at about 80 hours, so 3 or 4 days. And the half-life of on plastic, that is to say, it's still pretty strong at 6 to 8 hours. So back to surfaces, right? If I think we can extrapolate that stainless steel and plastic are probably going to be the same as linoleum or close to it. I don't think linoleum is going to kill it. I don't think vinyl is going to kill it. So we want to give everything a good 60 hours. You want to give everything 4 days outside if you can't spray it. That's stainless steel, plastic. And if a surface that is stainless steel or plastic wrapped stuff, you have to assume that that's contaminated and rinse it off, wipe it off, use the bleach water. I would not waste my, unless I had an unlimited supply of silver, I would not waste it sterilizing surfaces. So moving to our next thing, I want to take a moment and just share with you something that came into my head when I was doing my meditation this afternoon. And I want to emphasize, meditate. If you know how, to do this, it raises your immunity. It improves your innate immunity, even against bugs your poor little system has never seen before. And we've got a pretty stellar innate immunity that evolution has gifted us with. So just remember that meditations are really good. And I'm going to also post this on the website at AskDrDawn.com, but I want to read this to you. This is an inspirational comment. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. And where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. I thought of that this afternoon. That comes from an epic novel of the 60s or 70s by Frank Herbert called Dune. It was made into kind of a B-movie, but the book is awesome and highly recommend it if you are stuck in lockdown and want something to read. So let's talk a little bit about what we know so far about our friend, and this is an analysis of, you know, why has it been so contagious? What is it about it? We've had enough time now. SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 is part of the family of coronaviruses, and they cause about a third of common colds. This one, SARS was about a decade ago. These previously pretty harmless viruses started to kind of, well, there was a mutation, and they became much more contagious and capable of getting deep into the lungs. That was not something they did before. So they mutated and got better at grabbing onto something, a surface marker that's displayed on a whole lot of body tissues, including your liver and your intestines as well as your lungs, but it's a lot in the lungs. These viruses were capable of causing acute respiratory distress syndrome, which is the situation where you get the cytokine storm. It kind of burns your lungs, and the capillaries start to leak. And the capillaries are surrounding the alveoli, so the alveoli get filled with water, and this is a kind of drowning situation. If you lose enough of your alveoli, you have no more air sacs. And what we have to do in that circumstance is put you on a ventilator and blow air really hard into your lungs. Not at scuba diving pressure, but at multiples of atmospheric pressure. And what that does is it forces the fluid out of the alveoli and allows you to have some air getting down there so that it can move into your bloodstream. Getting back to the COVID-19. It's a spiky ball. You've seen that. The spikes allow it to stick. They're shaped a little bit differently. Think about orchids and the different shapes of the flowers. Well, these viruses have different shapes of these spiky things that you've seen on the surface. And they adhere far more strongly to this surface marker called ACE2. And a paper we talked about last week looked at, you know, is why are diabetics and hypertensive more likely to get this? And could it be because they're on drugs that raise ACE2? And that was a speculation that seems to have gotten a lot of pushback, but I think appropriately so, because it's the sort of speculation you should keep to yourself and not put out on the internet, because it's not helpful. That's really the point. You know, put it on a back channel, but don't put it on the internet, please. Especially don't tweet it. Okay, so back to this virus. There's a, the spike has is basically only active once it splits. So there are two lines that are held together by a little protein, and that protein has to be cleaved. And there, in SARS-CoV-2, the way it's built, it's easy for an enzyme that's also present right next to the ACE2 on the surface of the cells, called furin, to cleave it. So it spreads a lot more easily because it gets broken down into an infectious form in our bodies. It's actually, once it gets in, we process it to make it infectious. And that's true of all of these viruses, but this one's kind of spring-loaded. So it gets down into the lungs, and it's able to be, it's able to get a root there. More of it is getting down into the lungs, which makes sense, because ordinarily you have a pretty good system for keeping particles from getting down into the lungs. So only a few get down there. But if the thing that gets down there is really contagious, then you're going to end up with a concern. I just want to say that the cytokine storm that we've already referred to is happening only in a very, very small number of people. What preliminary research suggests, and I'll come to that in a moment, is that maybe there may be some genetic variation that explains the idiosyncrasies that are emerging as we compare COVID-19 across countries. It may be genetic as well. So, Marion writes, any idea how long the virus might live on dog fur? Cute puppy ran in, up to me, and I couldn't resist loving it up. I'm sure it was good for my immune system. Do I need to wash my clothes and everything he touched? Thanks. Marion, it's a good question, and I have not seen any data specifically on puppy fur, but I think that we can extrapolate from cardboard and paper. So I think you need to wash your hands, because they're going to have potentially some virus on them if the owner has the virus and is sick. I saw a question somewhere, I don't remember where someone was talking about being quarantined essentially in their house because they had been exposed and they were waiting for their test. So while they were waiting for their test to come back negative, they were in their own bedroom, and family members were bringing them their food, wearing a mask, and then going out and washing their hands. But the dog had gotten in a couple of times, and this person was concerned that what did they need to do? And the answer from the infectious disease people was, now that's, I think, based on other viruses, and indeed in general, and I don't know specifically about SARS, the dog hair is not a good vector for viruses. And so far, I have not seen any evidence that domestic animals such as dogs or cats are getting infected or being carriers of SARS in their saliva. And I have specifically looked for that. So last time I checked, which was a couple days ago, when one of my patients asked me, that was not a thing. So let's hope that it stays not a thing. I'm going to give Howard a little space to make station identification, and then we'll continue with this fascinating story about genetic variation and its implications for COVID-19.
Thank you, Dawn. Reminder that in 20 minutes we'll have Giant Steps Jazz from 7 until 10 p.m. I'll be your host. And one quick public service announcement here. Remember to maintain social distancing to avoid exposure to the coronavirus in observance of shelter-in-place orders, even while outdoors. Parks and open spaces offer many opportunities for outdoor exercise while maintaining safe distancing. Outdoor exercise is encouraged, but please follow safe distancing of shelter-in-place orders meant to protect public health. At this time, the police want to educate people rather than issuing citations for gathering in groups. So, to protect your health and everyone's health, if the area you want to visit is crowded, alter your schedule to when there are fewer people, or find a safer location elsewhere outdoors. I'm just making a practice of biking around and waving to people on the sidewalk, or waving to people across the street as they walk their dogs, for example. You can visit SantaCruzParksAndRec.com for a list of Santa Cruz open areas and parks. The golf course is closed, and use of this facility is prohibited at the moment. For updates on the City of Santa Cruz and its response to COVID-19, you can visit the website City of Santa Cruz, that's all one word, cityofsantacruz.com/coronavirus. And for general health information, you can visit santacruzhealth.org/coronavirus. All right, I'm going to send things back now to Dr. Dawn.
All right, I'm here. Thank you, Howard. And let's talk a little bit about the, I want to ping on your public service announcement and also say that ventilation is really good. I mentioned that I was talking about surfaces earlier, but the stuff really only stays in the air, floating in the air for a couple of hours, 2-3 hours. Now, if you have a fan or a ventilator or just an exhaust fan in your bathroom and you keep that running, particularly in that situation where someone in the house is sequestering, open the windows. You know, open the windows so if you can ventilate your space and move air through it, and that's going to help. I've been ventilating my office, keeping the doors open and keeping my exhaust fans on when I do see patients. And of course, I have a special, I have a set one space for patients that are there for a laceration or a tick bite or whatever else, and a different space because I am self-sequestering. When I do see patients, I am in full protective gear, and that's for their safety as well as mine. But nevertheless, we are going to get through this, and all sorts of creative strategies are emerging. I'm really glad to hear these questions. Thank you so much. I'm getting some additional ideas. Also things to do and check on and get back to you next week. So I mentioned that there's a lot of interest around genetic variation. So we're going to do a deep dive now, stay on this genetics topic. And the human genome, that's been around for quite a while. And now we have online all sorts of catalogs of complete human genomes in various countries. So this research published in the Cell Discovery Journal, so I'm not going to bother to give you the reference numbers. What these researchers did was they looked at the East Asian database and they analyzed all of the 1,700 different variations of that ACE2 gene, because there's been a lot of speculation that you get two completely seeming identical 40-year-olds, both smokers, both male, both from the same area. One of them dies from, gets rapidly sick and goes into ARDS, and the other one has a light cold. What's the X factor here? And we haven't been able to find the X factor, so we always start thinking about genetic susceptibility. And it turns out that there are some variations of the ACE2 inhibitor that are fairly common in China and fairly rare in Europe. Much less common. This was a population mixed American, African, and European compared to the China map. And what seems to be emerging is that there are some higher risk variants of this ACE, and that is a hypothesis. So what they're looking at is distribution of these mutations in hotspots, and it does seem to be that the hottest spots are the ones that have a specific variant. This raises the hope that we'll be able to risk stratify individuals quickly at the time if we can get some rapid throughput analysis for this gene. And this sort of thing is probably a couple of months out, but we're going to have this virus around for a while. So when we finally get our act together, I can envision a situation where we will basically, you come in, you have a fever and a cold, we swab you. The swab is at a turnaround time of 45 minutes. You then get your blood drawn for or your cheek swab for a genetic test, and you are in quarantine until you come out with either being high risk or low risk. And I could actually, you know, I want to inject a certain amount of optimism here. We're going through a bad patch. It's going to be a bumpy night, as they say in that lovely old movie. We will get through this. And when we are on the other side of it, we will have a different set of strategies and a different set of tools that will allow us to get back to normal. This is like a war. It's not normal, and it won't be normal for a while. But we will get back there. I am fully confident. This is not, guys, this is not the zombie apocalypse. And, you know, there's not going to be a fringes of humans you know, hiding out from whatever, the aliens, the zombies, the COVID-19. This is just not the scenario that is going to occur. We will get through this. We will get immunity. We will get strategies. We're going to get a vaccine. It's all going to happen. It's just not going to happen right away. And I'm really pleased to see our government finally taking steps. Let's just say we need to kind of keep things rolling, and everyone needs to remain calm and recite that litany against fear. Before you act emotionally, remember, when you're feeling an emotion of fear, your brain is shut down. You're not thinking clearly. Take a moment. Maybe recite that. Maybe do your breathing 60 seconds before you decide that you're going to react. Stand in that line, and that grocery line that Howard was talking about. Or do that. Whatever thing that's being fear generated, stop, take a break, let your critical thinking faculties regain their strength before you go any further. In the short run, what can you do politically? You can basically lobby everywhere for retooling. And retooling American production facilities to make valuable things. Right now, the most valuable things are personal protective equipment, because our most valuable natural resource at the moment is our doctor and nurse and paramedics and firemen and our first responder workforce, but particularly the ambulances and the medical people on the front lines. These are our most precious resource. They really are. We have to keep them from getting sick. And what is happening, I should say, all over the world is nobody has enough personal protective equipment. And it needs to come out of hiding. It needs to go into the stream. We have to keep our first responders. So the government needs to release that supply. And like I said, order somebody to start making it. We need that to happen right away. If you tweet, then tweet it. If you email your congressman, email your congressman. In fact, email all the congressmen. If you can, get the word out to your people, your friends and neighbors, wherever they are, and particularly if they're in an area where people have been kind of twiddling their thumbs a little bit. Florida comes to mind. We've got to keep our doctors alive. We've got to make ventilators. We've got to mobilize. And it's to the extent that we do that, we'll make a huge difference. That's not up to you. What's up to you is to behave yourself and not expose anybody, including yourself, because this asymptomatic period where people are shedding virus, it's irresponsible. You could even say, what did they use in that cop show, callous disregard or something like that? You simply can't, it's callous disregard for other people's lives to endanger them. So please, please get the word out, and let's start doing a little bit of it, maybe some social shaming. If we're a shame culture, well then fine, let's take the shame culture and run with it and leverage it. this is going to get better, but it's going to take a while. The next few months are going to be difficult. I read a really interesting article today in The Atlantic about this. And this article basically was very optimistic, and I found it inspiring. I am corrected. We have a general link to The Atlantic articles, and we'll post that. This one is called How Will the Virus End? And you can go and find it on that link. So even though we are separated and being apart, I want to encourage people to find other ways to being together. I've seen a lot of heartwarming things about sing-alongs, and thank God Zoom and the internet seem to be holding together beautifully, but we have the bandwidth to reach out to each other, and we need to do that. So we also need to be really careful not to stigmatize people who've recovered. We need to be very gentle with and supportive of our healthcare people. When people did go through a long-term quarantine, it was very difficult, and a lot of children may carry scars from this. What we don't want to do, and we saw this in Morocco when we were there, is we don't want to decide that anyone who's Chinese is evil and start doing what the Moroccans did, which was stigmatizing an entire ethnic group. We don't want to, we want to make sure that children understand it, that it is explained to them well. We have some stuff that's out on the county health public website. And there's one about how to talk to children about the COVID, how to explain it to them in a way that doesn't terrify them. The county health site is santacruzhealth.org. And it's in our document, so you can find it there as well. But they have a lot of good bits of advice, good releases for the community. It's being curated. New stuff goes up all the time. And I am very proud. I just want to say, I am so very, very proud of my community and my community's response and my community's compliance to Dr. Newell's public health order to shelter in place. We are going to get through this, and we are going to come through with flying colors, because we are who we are and because of what we are doing and because we started early. So keep that in mind and keep on keeping on. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.